Why do you think people wanted their own personal computers? What's the origin of that desire among so many computer users?
It's sort of natural. I'd rather have my own car than have to take buses. It's something like it in there. It just seemed though very hard to tell. They were just unconvincible, a lot of people were, that the personal computing had long ways to go. But anyway, I eventually got fired. And, you know, this shift in the perspectives and the things. And one of the big reasons was I lost support from government agencies because the peer review would come through slashing away, you know. Engelbart doesn't know about personal computers or something coming, but the paradigms were just so different.
Getting back to your 1968 demo, you were actually in San Francisco and controlling a computer that was actually in your lab in Menlo Park, which was a remarkable, remarkable feat for the day, in addition to the fact that the computer itself was extraordinary. Can you tell us something about the circumstances of that demo and how you pulled it off?
It started with our hearing what we, and we demonstrated, so they said, okay, well, what do you want? I want a time-sharing computer so I can really build the service up. So we'd gotten this one the spring before, and I just thought, it's so hard to try to tell people what it is we're trying to do. It'd just be marvelous to show them. So I just applied to the organizing committee for the conference, and, oh, this is so different. So they sent someone down to talk to us and look at us, and finally they cautiously said okay, because it was a gamble for them too. We had to make homemade modem set up for communicating. There's just a lot of special attention given there, but the actual way the computer worked were the things we were building anyway. And we actually had to pipe the video up to a, you know, wideband video channels that we had to rent. People came and put dishes on our roof and dishes. It was quite a bit of expense in there, but 5 years later or something, we were doing this as a matter of course with the network connections.
The photographer for the event was Stuart Brand, who is very much still a figure here in the Bay Area. He was best known for founding the Whole Earth Catalog right nearby in Menlo Park, quite close actually to Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. He was someone who was familiar with and fascinated with the NLS system. It seems that the motto of the Whole Earth Catalog, access to tools, in its own way is about augmentation and empowering people. How much contact did you have with the folks in Menlo Park who were in these counterculture movements at the time?
Just minimal. We were empathetic, and he was actually sort of, his office space was for a while was right nearby. Was somebody else was having I can't remember the guy's name, who had office space right there in Menlo Park across the street. So Stuart hung out there, and we got acquainted, and our guys were mostly the same kind of sort of hippie-oriented. And so when we were setting all this up, we just realized we could use another volunteer to run one of the cameras, so he was brought in, but he wasn't involved to any extent with our work.
Your workplace at SRI was certainly non-traditional for the time period, in an era when everyone at IBM wore blue suits, white shirts, and ties to work. Your employees were not only wearing different clothes, but they were lounging on beanbag chairs and practicing yoga and enjoying certain recreational substances at your workplace. People have commented on the self-indulgent workplaces of Silicon Valley in the 90s, but it seems like SRI was pioneering there as well.
It wasn't what I'd call self-indulgent. The pot was sort of say, okay, people are smoking pot around there, but not during work hours. My oldest daughter was going to local high school there, and we were going to move so she went to that high school, and so she'd come back over to our lab and sit around, hang around till I took her home. And so she said, "Dad, I would have been able to tell instantly if anybody had been smoking pot around during the working days." I was lenient about times are changing and ways of thinking are changing, but I wasn't tolerant about people actually butting up their heads while they were supposed to be working.
But do you think the more lenient atmosphere, as you describe it, where people weren't judged on how they were dressed or how they cut their hair, was an important contributing factor to the engineering efforts at SRI?
Well, our lab was the only place where it was really starting to do that. And I don't know what to compare it with, because there were so many other things different about our work and our orientation.
Your work was very different from your colleagues at SRI, for example.
Oh, I was different about, for instance, informal dress. I grew up in the country, and I never felt comfortable like that, so it was fine with me. I didn't see what matter it is. But things that would get in the way of doing their work effectively or something, I would have been not at all empathetic with that. When things like Werner Erhard's Est grew up, came out, and somebody explained that to me, and hey, that was good. So I went and participated in one of the sessions and thought, gee, there's really something novel about the effects he's producing in people. So I said, okay, I'll support people going. Werner actually invited me on his board of directors then, and judge and priests and lawyers and all kinds of top-level citizens. It wasn't until somewhat later when his actions got to be a little more than I liked. Then I sort of split off, but sure, there were just thinking about the paradigms that seemed to control how we worked and a lot about how we thought were, it just seemed to me, things to be changed.
Do you think that Werner Erhard was interested in the kind of augmentation that you were interested in? Did he strike a chord with you for that reason?
No, it was not quite the kind, but it was a component of that, of saying, you know, the way you think and orient yourself about things has a big impact on the effectiveness of it all. And it that sort of thing resonated. He got a little too far out for me, and I sort of abdicated towards the end of his reign here. I have friends that stayed sort of in touch with all that. They say it's getting to be a sounder sort of orientation.
You were very active during your years of great productivity that are discussed in What the Dormouse Said in the local folk dancing community. Folk dancing is a sort of activity that people recommend as a networking exercise. You don't seem like a networker, but nonetheless, you met a lot of engineers and friends that way.
Well, it was sort of more that my engineers and friends I brought into it. But as I said, I've been a country kid that didn't ever have a chance to learn to do social dancing well at all. But there's something about the folk dancing that, boy, the day I saw it, I just loved it. And it is very different, so yes. That was sort of got to be my social environment, the dominant one, and I met my wife that way. Lots of friends.
Do you think ability in folk dancing is a good predictor for computer science genius?
I wouldn't go that far. There's a freedom about it, a lot more emotion. It's that people just are a lot sort of more joyous looking and acting. You see the grinning and the smiling and as they're all moving around, and not like the that's so much more playful and joyful sort of than the picture of the social dancing.
So Allison's asking about predictors of good people. As you were interviewing people and met people as potential people in your lab, what did you look for? What sparks, what specific creative instincts did you look for, and what did you find were predictors of good people?
I hadn't reflected on that ever, and I hesitate to say they were specific things. A lot more just on my intuition, I guess. So I'm sorry I can't give you a learned answer.